There are wonderful characters in her stories, and there's much history, a history that many of us really don't know much about or understand. Of her poems, other writers say they are elemental, spiritual, healing. Readers say they're also moving and beautiful. I'm Susan McGinnis. This is Conversations, and on this edition, please welcome writer Linda Hogan. Thank you for joining us, and welcome.
Thank you.
In the most recent book of poetry that we have in our hands, which is called The Book of Medicines, you write about hunger and you write about medicines after the title. I was attracted to the poems about hunger because there seem to be so many different kinds of hungers. I wonder if you'd explore this word a little bit, what hunger in your mind means to the humans on the planet and to the planet. Is that something you can walk with?
It is. And, you know, I was thinking as we're talking about this that my interest in this goes way back. And at one point in my life, I worked in a zoo. I've had a lot of working class jobs. Mm-hmm. And this one wasn't one of them, but I did do some work in a zoo in Colorado Springs. And one of the things I began to notice was that the people were more interesting to watch than the animals. And so very dignified men would come in and try to get eye contact with an orangutan, or they would beat their chest in front of the gorilla. And at first I was repulsed by this, that these humans would do this, because to me it seems very, it seems intrusive to the animals and invasive, you know, in a way. I mean, especially where I come from, if you make eye contact, it's considered to be, you know, that you're suspicious or it's some kind of an invasion. But I began to think about what this meant, and what I realized at one point it meant in this particular case was that these men were hungry for acknowledgement, and the women too, I don't want to make this one-sided, that they were hungry for acknowledgement and that they felt that they had the ability to connect with an animal more than they had the ability to connect with strangers that were humans. And that also they wanted a recognition that they were decent people from the eyes of the animals, which aren't necessarily they're not really willing to say this to us or to suggest it or to any way show it. And so I began then to think about what this longing is and what this desire is that humans have for these kinds of connections, particularly when they're people who have broken the connections in the first place. And so I started to think about all these forms of hunger, and also the forms of hunger that have really destroyed our planet, and economic hunger and legal hunger and sexual hunger and food hunger, and the fear that's behind so many of these hungers, so that when we aren't even hungry, we save things because we're afraid for the day that we might be.
There's something about filling empty places.
Filling empty places,
yeah,
right,
in
that's
hunger.
It.
This is Linda Hogan with us on Conversations. She's a Chickasaw Indian, a writer who began, she's in her mid-40s now, began writing in her late 20s, and has brought to the world a surprising number of books of poetry, of essays, short stories, a novel, and a play, a writer who writes across the genres, Linda Hogan. I wonder if you'd read from this second section called Hunger of this book and introduce us to one or two of the poems.
Well, I'm going to read a poem called Bear Fat. Then maybe I can tell you a little bit about how this poem came into being. Bear Fat. When the old man rubbed my back with bear fat, I dreamed the winter horses had eaten the bark off trees and the tails of one another. I slept a hole into my own hunger that once ate lard and bread from a skillet seasoned with salt. Fat was the light I saw through the eyes of the bear, three bony dogs leading men into the grass-lined cave of sleep to kill hunger as it slept itself then. They grew fat with the swallowed grease. They ate even the wood ashes after the fire died. And when they slept, did they remember back to when they were wolves? I am afraid of the future, as if I am the bear turned in the stomach of needy men, or the wolf become a dog that will turn against itself, remembering what wildness was before the crack of a gun, before the men tried to kill it, or tame it, or tried to make it love them.
Bear Fat, from The Book of Medicines by Linda Hogan. And you said you had thoughts about this poem to tell us.
Well, there are stories, numerous stories behind every poem, but this one in particular, I took a class in northern Minnesota, in Ely, Minnesota, on wolf, moose, deer populations, and I'm very interested in, I like to go to school still, and I'm really interested in the relationships animals have with each other. For instance, when I was there, one of the things that I learned was how crows and wolves cooperate with each other so that the ravens and crows will show the wolves and tell them where the moose are. And then after the moose kills the moose, I mean after the wolf kills the moose and eats their 25 pounds and crashes in a little, you know, rolled up ball because they're too full to move, then the crows can go in and eat. And so they have this working relationship. But I went a little bit further and thought about how I read that all domestic dogs came from wolves. They were once wolves, and they were bred into domesticity. And I found that to be, then they turned on their own ancestors. They went back, and they were used to help hunt and kill the wolves. And in some ways, that interests me for several reasons. One is that what happens in the cell structure when you forget what you come from and forget who you come from, but also in that way of being a mixed blood person, because when I go back and I look at history and I look at how in many cases there was so much suspicion between full blood Indian people and the mixed blood, because the mixed blood in a way seemed to be one step towards domesticity, like a dog, or at least somehow in the American imagination, the full blood person in the white American imagination tends to represent wildness in a way that the mixed blood person doesn't. Mm-hmm. And so somehow I followed all of this back, but it begins with the rubbing of the back with bear fat. And at one time in my life, and I think it was around 1985, I was sick and I went to see a traditional healer, and it was a woman, not a man, but I'm not to give her identity away. And that was one of the things that she did, was rub me with bear fat. And there was sort of this medicinal plants and medicinal elements of trade that go back and forth all across the country that most people are not aware of. But, you know, you trade a certain root or herb and somebody else will bring you a little can of salve, and, you know, from bear fat, or a certain kind of soil, you know, that, you know, red ochre or something like that that you can't get in Missoula, Montana, or someplace. So it began with that and moved through that kind of hunger that wants to be well, the kind of hunger that's poverty, that, you know, I had a friend one time and we thought it was a feast if we had bacon fat and bread. That was like our meal. And we thought it was great. It really was, actually. It tasted really good. And I just moved that into the bear and then the wolf and, you know, all of the all of those processes really come into this poem, I think. The wilderness as well as domesticity.
Mm-hmm. I want to just touch on one small place of that, because you've led us to a number of different places that you talked about what I think of as cellular thoughts, that the dogs have connections with wolves and the hunters have connection with wolves, and like the medicine woman who trades for her mm-hmm. herbs, she's going back through centuries and carrying cellular thoughts through to your healing. Mm-hmm. In your reading, is there a place on the planet, and I mean not necessarily a physical place, where cellular thoughts are conscious thoughts, or are they always working on us from places that are not acknowledged, not conscious, not present, and so delicate and easy to lose?
I'm not sure they're easy to lose, but I think that they become something that we don't know what it is. We can't name it. And for someone like myself, I have great fortune that I can use language, because it seems to me that buried things come up in that language of writing, a story or a poem. You know, I think so often about what happened in my history, in the history of my own community, my own people, and how the struggle to survive, you know, the Trail of Tears, for instance, the women who were grieved so much that the other women would take them and say, you have to come on, somebody has to live.
Survival is...
They carried me inside their bodies. I am their blood and the blood of those men. And so their survival is in me. And in a way, you know, sometimes as a writer, I think about that very consciously and what I owe them, you know, what I am responsible to say from that place. But
this is one reason why, at least one reason why there are so many books from a woman who just began 15, 17 years ago to write.
Right.
Yeah. It's a bursting of a dam.
And began really in such an out of balance way in my own life, because all those voices were there inside me and I had no words for them. And you know the experience when you're having an emotional feeling, but you don't know what it is. But somebody else tells you, oh, this must be happening. And you say, that's it. And then all of a sudden it's clear. And I think that happens to a lot of Indian people, that we have these memories. We know another way, but it's been so submerged and so covered over by what we've been taught we should be like, know, do, you know, what we should not do. And it's there, just ripening and waiting for some kind of recognition.
Does the writing for you help you to identify that smoky place you talked about?
Yes, that is, yeah. Yes. And not only that, it helps me to identify it for other people too. Mm-hmm. And I think there it crosses cultural boundaries. That what I want to do is go for an emotion that somebody has to acknowledge. You know, some ways, you know, it's like looking for cheap thrills. My friend Lucy, that's a Navajo, who grew up, you know, with mutton and sheep and lamb, she always said sheep thrills when she talks about Navajo life, and, you know. But it's, in a way, I learned a lot from taking this one class. I took a weekend class one time in film, writing film script. And when I was working on Mean Spirit, I took this class because I realized at this one point that I really don't know what a story is. That I know one when I hear one, but I can't put it together. And so in this film writing class, and, you know, this man never would have to write a screenplay because there was everybody that was in there wanted to write one and get $500,000. So he made $500,000 teaching this class, probably. It was completely filled up. Mm-hmm. And he talked about how story unfolds. And he also said the way to sell a movie is that you have a movie that makes people feel feelings. That why people go to movies is to have an emotional experience. And I began to apply that to fiction writing. I applied that then, thinking about what should a poem do, that a poem in some way, as surface and topical as that sounds, a poem should have that emotional weight, and a story should have that emotional weight. So that's what I look for when I'm working.
Yeah. This is Linda Hogan. I was going to ask you, and I think you've just answered this then, do essays feed poems, which feed stories, which feed novels, which feed essays, which feed poems? Does this all run in cycle? Not many writers write across the genres. They say, right. No, I'm a poet, or I'm an essayist. And you seem to have the whole world of the pen in your hand, or heart, or something.
Well, I think particularly in the United States, people have categories for themselves like that because, you know, you look at the Canadian writers and Margaret Atwood, and you look at Michael Ondaatje, and, you know, they do all these different things. And, you know, I think that in some ways it limits us to only do one genre, to only write one way, or to only do one thing in our lives. And what I do is I look for the form that will accommodate what I'm trying to do and write and say. And sometimes it picks itself. with Mean Spirit, for instance, I figured I have got to learn how to write a novel. I had to teach myself. I've never had a fiction class. And I thought, how am I going to tell this story? I can't do it in a poem. I couldn't really do it in an essay, and I really am not interested in writing history because it's already all over the place, and most of it's not that interesting, you know, right, compared to reading a novel. So I felt like I had to figure out how to write this novel just to tell these stories. And so that's what I do, basically, is I look around for the form. Or if I'm writing something and I don't know what it's going to be, it's just a word, it starts with an image or a word, then I let it turn out into whatever it will become.
You've mentioned a book a couple of times, and we should stop and talk about this book, partly so I will be a happy girl, because I have been reading it, and it is, it's just a magnificent book. Mean Spirit was published in 1990 by Athenaeum in the United States, simultaneously in Toronto and in London and in Singapore and in Sydney. It's available in hardback and from Ivy Books. Is Ivy a branch of Athenaeum? Do you know that?
No, it's not. I can't remember. I think Another. It's either Dell or Bantam. It says in the front of it.
I forgot. If this book is attractive to you when we're done with this hour together, yes, published by Ballantine Books. Ivy Books is the paper. It also came out in 1990. Tell us, to your own comfort level and somewhat briefly, about this story. These things that you describe in Mean Spirit happened to people who are of your culture and your land and other cultures on this same land, and happened not so very long ago. And I'll just say that much and ask you to find a round place that will give us some part of this story.
Well, in around 1916, I think it is, when oil and natural gas and other resources were discovered in Oklahoma, that desolate land that the United States government tried to herd all the native people into, suddenly became, you know, filled with non-Indian people who were coming in from all over the world to try to find ways to keep to get the oil and the gas for themselves. And it ended up being a number of cases of murder, insurance fraud, and various other kinds of crime against the tribal people there, through which they were taken from their own land and own rights to the land and to the resources. And my family originally is from South Central Oklahoma, and the novel is not set in that area, although the landscape is more the South Central landscape than it is up in Osage County. And this is a story that, in a way, I felt followed me around until I did something with it. Mm-hmm. And I was always interested in the story of the Depression because of the effect that it had on my own community and what happened to my grandparents and uncles and everybody in the 1930s. And there was a woman that I met when I had a tribal historian fellowship in Chicago to do research. And I met Carol Hunter, who was an Osage, and we became friends and spent many a long night talking, and we wanted to do a project together on the Depression. And then she started talking about these events that took place, which she had interviewed one of the murderers after he was out of jail. And I always thought that was such an incredible act of courage to go talk to a murderer of your own people, to be able to do that in a way, you know, as a scholar, to try to just get a feel for what this person was thinking of.
To be open to his story without injuring yourself, yeah.
Right, or but him, I to suppose. Him and to the other men at that time, Indian people were not human beings. And so their sense was that Indians were standing in the way of progress, and it was really their duty to kill the people so that they could have the money. Speaking about hunger, you know, this is another form of hunger, sort of gone insane and gone wild and out of control. So Carol and I started talking, and we decided we were going to do some kind of a project on this oil boom. And what happened was that she left for Oklahoma, and she took a teaching job. And, of course, once you take a teaching job, It's very rare you will be able to do very much. And you know, I always thought it was kind of strange that when you have a teaching job, you don't even get time to read, so you become really illiterate in a hurry. You know? But she then had to do some scholarly things, and so she started a book on Posey. Alexander Posey, who was a Creek poet of the turn of the century, 1900. And so she never came back to this. And so at that time, I went to a ceremony and I met a woman who gave me a little bit of more of this story. And I'd already heard the stories from my father, you know, and from my relatives. And then every time I turned around, a new piece of this was coming in. And then I moved away and took a job. And one day this woman from New York called and she said, you know, I hear you wrote a play, and I'm an Osage actress, and I was wondering if you would write a screenplay, or if you'd be interested in writing a screenplay about these events, because I'm looking for a part to play.
Boy, you had a lot of pressure on your life to write this story.
I know, yeah. I really did. And then my father and I also had interviewed elders, and they told the story of my great-grandfather, who was one of the people who hired killers. And he was a non-Indian, and he married my great-grandmother for what he believed was power and money, and then disowned all the children that married Indian people. Like my grandmother married, my grandfather was both Chickasaw and Choctaw, and he was very dark, and her white father disowned her so she never could go back home, and one of my aunts also. So there, you know, this is all adding to this story, and I hope you can follow all of these things,
yes.
That they're clear. So finally, I just decided I'm going to sit down and I'm going to start working, and so I did. And I did a script first, and Diane and I tried to shop it around and see if somebody would be interested, and we had a few nibbles, but it never panned out. And so at that time, I started writing the novel also, and I was involved with this book for years. I think it was 1986. That I started working on it full time, and about a year later, it just didn't seem like it was going anywhere. I'd never written a novel. I had no idea what I was doing. And one day I said, I have got to make a decision whether I want to keep doing this or quit. And I decided to keep doing it. And the next day, the agent I'd sent sample writing to called and said that he had somebody that wanted to buy it. And so for the, you know, like a minimal price, I sold it thinking this is terrific. And
more,
you know,
pressure.
What?
More pressure.
Right. Right. And so, and there it was. Then it happened and it came out, and people, surprisingly, it worked. You know, I'm still amazed that I could do this. This is like Linda Hogan is another person that does all this work than I am, you know. I'm the normal person, and she just, you
right.
know.
You wash the dishes and she writes
things.
The books.
That's right. Yes. I don't clean windows. I just leave them dirty.
Right. Linda Hogan is talking about Mean Spirit, a novel. Linda Hogan teaches at the University of Colorado Creative Writing Program. She teaches about a course a semester and is free to write with the rest of her life, which is a lucky and a privileged place, and also a scary place, I would think, to kind of confront yourself as a writer in an ongoing way. Among her books, besides Mean Spirit, The Book of Medicines, from which she read earlier, was published by Coffee House Press in 1993, her most recent book. There's a book of short stories called That Horse. She's co-editor of a book called Stories We Hold Secret, from Greenfield Review Press. As I mentioned before, there are essays and there is a play sometime back. This is an odd question. At the beginning of the book, in the early pages of Mean Spirit, I fell in love with Grace Blanket, who is a complicated, free, idiosyncratic, fun-loving human being who dies early on.
Right.
And around about page 100, a third or so of the pages of the book, I realized that I was wearing a weight of grief from the number of people who I had learned to like or love in moments and who had been taken away in brutal and callous ways. And I kept wondering how you did all this, not how you did it, but how you bore all of this in the process of writing, knowing that these deaths were true and real and happened to human beings that one could fall in love with, enjoy in on the planet in their time, and writing about other people of your own creation who you must have also learned to love. Was this a terribly hard thing to do? I guess that's what I'm working towards.
Well, in the beginning it is, but I think one of the things that needs to be understood is that most Indian people bear that weight every day from childhood, because in some ways, you know, while non-Indian people tend to think of all this history as something in the past and that they've started a new life, I think we see history in a very present way. Maybe it's a difference in perception of time, but one of my friends and I were talking one time, we were roommates at a conference, and we were talking about how she was saying that when her family gets together, they talk about the Navajo Long Walk and all the people that died as they were taken to, I think it's Fort Sumter, that they were made to go to, and they had to stay. They stayed until the population was greatly decreased. They had epidemics of typhoid and all kinds of other illnesses, and then they were told they could go back home, and by then there were only a quarter of the people remained. And she said that when they get together, they still talk about that and cry. And so in some ways I feel like that grief has been with me all of my life and forced me to have a different kind of insight that than some people who haven't been through that experience so very recently. I mean, this is not a long time ago, and when I was doing research for a project I was working on, I was doing historical research, and I realized at one point that all Native people on this continent knew what was going on with each other, so that while the Civil War maybe is going on in one place, the Indian people were being herded around and murdered and massacred. And then, earlier there was the gold rush in California where the population decreased by 90%. That was the average decrease. As soon as there was white contact, the population was, what was left was usually 10% that survived white contact. And so, I began to think about what this meant to my family, to my own people, and I realized that my grandmother was 7 years old at the time of the massacre at Wounded Knee. She knew this. They knew what was happening. This colored her whole life, and how free she was to be herself, or how much she had to hide of herself, or how much to stay out of the white world, or how much to enter in. And that, you know, that knowledge and the psychology and the trauma is passed down. I don't know how many generations it takes to get it out. And, you know, one of my daughters is enrolled at Pine Ridge in South Dakota. And I know a number of people from there, and it's the same thing. I think, you know, the people who are there are broken, and non-Indian people tend to blame them for their own circumstances. Mm-hmm. But they don't realize that these are people who walked out of death. They're people who walked out of a massacre, that they survived all is miraculous. And why would anybody expect them to walk out of that and be a perfectly emotionally healthy, well-adjusted person? It's impossible for this generation. So I don't know if that answers your question.
Yes.
But
Linda Hogan speaking to us. We have not talked about reading from Mean Spirit. I wonder if there is a place that is an introductory read that you have in mind from this book. And if not, we can go on. Your thoughts?
We can try it.
Sure.
This is a paperback, and I only found them in hardcover.
You're used to the hardback?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Maybe I'll just start at the beginning, because
good.
Belle Greycloud, she was my boss. She was my mentor. She was the one that made me get up at 6 in the morning and write down her story and tell her, and, you know, tell what she wanted to say.
This is what you meant the other night when you said there are characters who sit and talk in your ear until you write them down?
That's right.
This
and is they
Belle.
And I hear their voices, and they'll say things like, my new character says, I was 17 when I returned, and it's her voice I hear, not mine. But Belle Greycloud, she's trying to move into another character right now because she's just, you know, she's an activist. She's not going to be quiet at all. And when
Take
I get
me to
old,
the next
I'm going
to
be like her, right, to the next book. I'm going to be, you know, she's great. She keeps back the sheriff and everybody else. She's a very moral person. This takes place in Oklahoma, 1922. That summer, a water diviner named Michael Horse forecast a 2-week dry spell. Until then, Horse's predictions were known to be reliable, and since it was a scorching hot summer, a good number of people moved their beds outdoors in hopes a chance breeze would pass over and provide relief from the hot nights. They set them up far from the houses that held the sun's heat long after dark. Cots were unfolded in kitchen gardens. White iron beds sat in horse pastures. Four posters rested in cornfields that were lying fallow. What a silent bedchamber the world was just before morning, when even the locusts were still. In that darkness, the white beds were ghostly. They rose up from the black rolling hills and farmlands. Here, a lonely bed sat next to a barbed wire fence, and there, beneath the protection of an oak tree, a man's lantern burned beside his sleeping form. Near the marshland, tents of gauzy mosquito netting sloped down over the bony shoulders and hips of dreamers. A hand hung over the edge of a bed, fingers reaching down toward bluegrass that grew upward in fields. Given half a chance, the vines and leaves would have crept up the beds and overgrown the sleeping bodies of people. In one yard, a nervy chicken wanted to roost on a bed frame and was shooed away. "Go on, scat," an old woman cried out, raising herself half up in bed to push the clucking hen back down to the ground. That would be Belle Greycloud. She was a light-skinned woman, the grandmother of her family. She wore a meteorite on a leather thong around her neck. It had been passed on to her by a man named Osage Star-Looking, who'd seen it fall from the sky and smolder in a field. It was her prized possession, although she also had a handwritten book by the old healer Severance. Belle slept alone in the garden. The rest of her family believed, in varying degrees, that they were modern, so they remained inside the oven-hot walls of the house. Belle's grown daughters drowsed off and on throughout the night. The men tossed, the two young people were red-faced and sweating, tangled in their bed linens, on sagging mattresses. Belle frightened away the hen, then turned on her side and settled back into the pillow, her silver hair spread over it. Even resting outside in the iron bed, surrounded by night's terrain, she was a commanding woman, with the first morning light on her strong-boned face. A little ways down the road toward Wetona, Indian Territory, a forest of burned trees was just becoming visible in morning's red firelight. Not far from there, at the oil fields, the pumps rose and fell, pulling black oil up through layers of rock. At that time in Oklahoma, the horizon, which is an enormous horizon in that particular area, there are no mountains visible, was completely obliterated by oil derricks. You could not see the horizon. That's how many there were. So you can imagine what it must have looked like and how destructive it was and how many people had come there to make $1 million off of oil.
And how it must have felt to people who were born and raised on the land and connected with the land and the horizon and sky.
And also how other people were so jealous of that possible wealth or potential wealth. And, you know, of course, I mean, when you look back over the records, the attorneys even made out like bandits, because they were bandits at that time. And so one person, say, would be considered to be an incompetent person, and that would be determined in a way that was not reasonable. They would be incompetent. And maybe they would have 17 attorneys who would charge attorney fees, legal fees, and in that way just bilk that person. They would lose all their money in a year. And, you know, non-Indian people didn't, they were judgmental about the way the people spent their money. If somebody bought two fancy cars, they thought they didn't deserve to have money or be alive or, you know, whatever, in whatever the way they wanted to judge that. Of course, I don't know what they'd think if there were BMWs and Saabs that cost more money than a home.
Yeah. Answer any part of this that you want. What's your own healing process like from these kind of cellular, historic, old and still living processes that you've been talking about?
Well, one of the things is I did not grow up in a traditional community, but I grew up with a traditional belief system. And so I work out of that. And this is so funny because you know how people in college get so skeptical and so cynical, and you're not allowed to speak things that are cliche. One of the students I worked with here said that he couldn't talk about the heart because that was such a cliche. And I thought, you know, isn't this sad that the things that are the most important to us are so trite, we're not supposed to write them or talk them about them. But one time I had a student that was saying something about shooting a herd of antelope or something, and, you know, and he was, I think he was just trying to get a take on what I might say, and I said, well, you know, I still believe in life. And he sort of sneered, but I thought, it's really true. I do still believe in life, and I really believe in respecting life. And so sometimes I feel terrible and I'm depressed, and then I think, no, you can do that a little bit now and then, you know, but you have to keep working on these same things. Even if it doesn't work, you just have to keep at it. One of my friends takes compassion holidays, and I try to do that. She says, okay, I'm going to take a compassion holiday. Today I'm not going to do anything that's going to make me feel depressed or sad. I'm not going to listen to NPR because, you know, it's very seldom you get good news over NPR, and I'm not going to turn on the TV. And, you know, and so I'm trying to follow her example. Compassion holidays.
It's very nice. Linda Hogan with us on Conversations. Among her several and many awards, there are those from the Guggenheim Foundation, from the National Endowment for the Arts, a Minnesota Arts Board grant, Colorado Writers Fellowship, the Five Civilized Tribes Museum Playwriting Award, and for Seeing Through the Sun, her fourth book of poetry, the American Book Award from the Before Columbus Foundation. Linda Hogan talking about her novel, based on fact, Mean Spirit, and reading from the Book of Medicines as well. At a craft talk I went to, you said the training of perception is the creative force for all things. And I've wandered around with that in kind of heart and mind since you said it. It seems to me that a Zen master and a healer would say the same thing. If I said, where is your source of your healing, or where is the source of your meditation? Can you show us what that means to you when you say the training of perception is the source of the creative force?
Well, I think I quoted John Hay also, you know, like maybe right after that, and I talked about his line from one of his books. I think it's called, that's the book on the immortal wilderness. And he said that where once you saw objects, now you see magnitudes. And I think it's about looking at something and really seeing. And, you know, do you remember years ago when people were doing EST? Mm-hmm. And they were going for these horrible weekends where they weren't even allowed to get out of the room to go to the bathroom.
Sure.
So they were humiliated, really, in so many ways. But a woman I knew did that, and afterwards she said, well, look, I see all the birds and the trees, and I thought, you know, is this what it takes to be able to see? You know, that you have to go through some crisis or, you know, have somebody bully you into being able to open your eyes and see. But I think that's it, and we fail to see things, and we fail to try to understand things or to stop and be quiet And I think particularly, I don't know if this is true everywhere, but it seems like this particular culture in this time and place, that there is really not much silence or much stopping, that everyone is on the go all day and all night. Everyone is working. They're tense, they're tight. You know what? Somebody else I knew was saying, you know, everybody used to just drink a lot of wine and have a good time, and now they all drink Starbucks and they're hyper all day. So maybe our addictions, you know, sort of indicate where we are psychologically and spiritually. Mm-hmm. But it does seem that there is an element of time sickness to this culture.
And time sickness means to you, got to be there by 5.
Right. Yeah. And you lose your integrity when you're in a hurry. You don't treat people with respect. There's not time to treat people with respect. That takes a little bit of time. There's not time for compassion or tenderness.
Tell me how you see the training of your own perception. What do you do when you're trying to connect yourself?
Well, I take a walk. That's one of the things. And the other one is I write, and I try to be quiet. And this doesn't happen always, but what I love is when I get to the point where I'm taken up by it. Something happens, and time passes, and I don't know, and I'm completely still. Even my skin is still, and my mind is still. And that's where I feel like true writing, true living comes from. But I don't know anybody that could maintain it because, you know, when you live in a place, you have to adapt to what's happening at that time in history. Someone I know once said that nobody in America wanted to go through the toxic experience of America, and that's what it is. It's a toxic experience. And, you know, particularly when I go to work, I work in Boulder, and I drive an hour to get there. And it's like going to a whole other world, you know. I can always tell I'm getting close because everyone's out in $150 running shoes, jogging and riding their bikes, and you know. But nobody there wants to be toxic. I mean, they live very clean lives for the most part. Mm-hmm. But walking is really good. And one of the things I also do when I'm walking is I try to think about what a human being is, or what's a human body, or you know, just to try to understand some very basic things. And thinking about those things are a form of exercise that function in a way as that acute perception that begins to take place. They turn into that perception.
You also have talked about doing writing exercises that will limber up what we now call the right side of the brain instead of getting that logical taskmaster exercise. You exercise the one that is process-oriented, intuitive, and floats off. And
right, yeah. Because the intellectual part of the brain isn't necessarily the creative part. And so I don't know if they're right or left. You know, I mean,
right, yeah.
Well, there's this corpus callosum or something, you know, and there's all these lobes, and I don't really know exactly if they're separate. I do know that they've done surgery on people who have extreme epileptic seizures, and some of the results don't indicate that you have right or left brain, but that they have different functions and
right.
And control different things. But the exercises really work well because if you can come up with one that will short-circuit your mind, you can usually write a really strong piece of whatever you're working on, poetry or fiction or even essay, much more quickly than trying to drag all that stuff through the mind and through the intellectual process.
Yeah.
It somehow sterilizes what you're saying.
You said something in, this is an interview that may be almost 10 years old at this point, but it was right after Mean Spirit was published, and the interviewer asked you, when did it, I don't know what the word she used, when did it click, when does it feel right? And you said, it's like being a baseball pitcher in the groove when writing works. And I really liked that. For anyone who's physical in any sort of way, that feeling of being just right there.
You know it's working.
Yeah, it goes right across the plate. Yeah, that was nice. It was interesting from your poetry. I kind of didn't expect you to give a baseball image. And
I don't even
response.
Remember doing it.
Right,
but
sure.
I'm glad I did. It sounds good.
Yes. You said your dad and your uncle were both imagistic, I think is the word you used, which I'd never seen before, but image-filled storytellers.
Oh, yes, they were really funny. And, you know, they talk. I mean, I don't know if I said they were imagistic, but they're very visual when they talk. And my Uncle Wesley was he was one of the people who really formed and shaped me. And actually, I think there was some conflict in the family about this, because I've gotten hints of it off and on, and he was not very kind to a lot of other people. But from the time I was really young, he decided I was going to be an Indian person, and he was going to make sure that I went to community events and to powwows. And then as I grew up, we had this close relationship. He also was a whittler. He could carve all these things in wood. He could have, you know, like carve a bird that actually moved inside of another piece of wood and things like that. He was very good at it. So he would carve, and these little wood chips would fall, and he'd say all these things. And one time he was talking about everyone in my family on my father's side. They were all musicians and still are. So when we have family reunions, there's all this music, and everyone sings and dances. And, you know, they go on all night, and all the wonderful old people have a good time. And so do the young people. But he would say things like, one thing he was talking about when he played the fiddle, that he couldn't read music because when he looked at the musical notes on the page, all they looked like was a bunch of crows sitting in the telephone wires. You know, and I really liked that. And I thought, this man is so creative. And my father was the same way. They would just have a way of putting things that was, they were born storytellers. And not only that, I'm not a great speaker like they were. I can't really tell a story, so I write instead. But they could tell a story, and they would know just intuitively where to end. They would never have an or an extra and or anything. And when we were in Oklahoma, too, it's a different kind of family structure or something. I mean, we would all be sitting outside at night watching the fireflies, and people would be talking and telling stories, and, you know, the young people would be chasing each other around trying to put ice down somebody's shirt, you know. So in a way, I came from a family of storytellers, and I couldn't do it the way they did, so I started writing instead. They thought I had a bladder problem because they'd say something interesting and I'd run in the bathroom and write it down. I didn't want them to know I was writing it. I was very shy about it.
Yeah. I want to ask you about something, and you may, if you don't want to answer it, just tell it to go away. You said somewhere where I was listening to you that your decision to go to school was an uncomfortable one for your family. And the reason I wanted to ask you about this is that I think this is so for not only Indian people, but for people who feel outside the society, and the family is very important. So if a child goes away, that child's abandoning more than a decision to stay in Waco or whatever.
Right. Well, and the thing that's really interesting about the reaction was that I was an older student. I wasn't a traditional college student, and I went at night in the beginning because I worked myself through, and so I worked all day, and then eventually I sort of changed that around and I'd work on weekends. And even at that late age, everyone was really disappointed in me that I was going to go to school. And I think part of it is that schools represented assimilation, and they represented the violence that had been done to families because children had been taken away and sent to boarding schools where they were abused more often than not. And so I think there was that, but it was also a class thing, you know. And when I went to school, we really didn't know about college or universities and things like that, but just that they were different kinds of people. I mean, we couldn't communicate with them, you know. They would, you'd see them, and, you know, their children were always very badly behaved, things like that, you know. So there were all these stereotypes about that. And I think they just thought I was going to leave them. One of my cousins, his name is James, and he runs the Indian Law Center in Saskatchewan now. He went into school, and he was sort of the, you know, we both ended up doing things that were related to tribes. He went and worked for the Mi'kmaq Nation, however. He's Southern Cheyenne. His mother was Southern Cheyenne as well as Chickasaw. So, you know, he got very involved in treaty rights, and then land claim rights in Canada. So he's gone in his direction, and we actually ended up at one point, we lost touch with each other. And recently we just got into contact again, only to discover we're both working on the same project. He's doing work on the same thing I'm doing work, which is really kind of an interesting connection. But I did go to school in spite of all that. And one year at a family reunion, one of my aunts said, you know, I know how hard you worked to go to school, and I want you to know that I'm really proud of you. And I thought that was really great, that she would say that. And then my family thought that, you know, I was going away, but when I started writing about, you know, our history or something like that, they felt a little bit better about it. And then when my mother saw Mean Spirit in Safeway, she bought it. And, you know, if you knew my mother, you know what a miracle that is. And plus, I'd already given her one. But she was just so thrilled, and she was telling them that that was her daughter. And, I mean, it was like, now that it was in Safeway, I'd really made it. So things are all right now.
Good.
But I do sense that people are a little uncomfortable with me sometimes because they don't know if I'm going to write about them or not.
That has to be an interesting thing, the writer as a stealer of souls. You know?
Right, yeah. And I'm really careful not to do that.
Mm-hmm. Linda Hogan with us on Conversations. Our time is fast escaping, and I probably picked out a dozen poems from this slim volume for you to read, but we've narrowed it down. I wonder if you'd narrow it down even further and pick one for another read. Oh, that would be very nice.
I want to read Other Sister Twin because it's a really lovely poem. And in a way, it comes back to some of the things we've been talking about how do you move into a part of yourself that understands the rest of the world. And that is part of the rest of the world. Other Sister Twin. She began with two lovers on the swept floor of earth. She was what passed between them. She was a gourd too heavy for the vine and full of her own wet seed. Her grandmother kept the red bag that held her stem so she would not forget the other women she lived inside. Before this ruined time. The beginning of hunger was in that bag with bones and the origins of betrayal. But there was the forgiving thing, the dry seeds of the rattle that could shake healing to a start. She stood naked and painted herself in the old way, a red hand across her face. She danced in the ceremony of fire that rose to the stars. She wrapped night's black skin around her shoulders and disappeared inside its dance. She is the one that lives now in the hand of the river that wants to flow away from itself but never does. And at night she falls beneath the water where once I woke wearing her painted skin. The red hand of it was on me. I knew I was the water and heard her say, above is the betrayed world, where our children are the children of strangers, along the lost road, in the land where barns are red, because they are painted with the blood and milk of mothers of what they hold. The closed bundles of healing are beginning to open. The first stem is growing like a vine. It holds the cure where you can reach through time and find the bare earth within your living hand. I say her name. It is earth calling land mother. It is glacier calling ice my daughter, my sister. It is ocean calling the river water.
Other Sister's Twin from the Book of Medicines, the book called The Book of Medicines. By Linda Hogan. This is Conversations with Minutes Left, just to remind you that there is a book called Mean Spirit, which is a novel. There is a book forthcoming, which we'll talk about in just a minute. And there are six books of poetry that I know of. The first one, Calling Myself Home, was written, published in 1978. Seeing Through the Sun, an award-winning poetry book by University of Massachusetts Press, brought out in 1985. Savings, which is another remarkable book of poetry, published by Coffee House Press in 1988. And the most recent, The Book of Medicines by Coffee House, brought out in 1993. This notion of where life blooms and remembers its history, there is, I don't know whether the word is hope for our future. Is that there?
I hope so.
Yeah.
I think there is still.
Yeah.
I worry about the land and the animals and the water, though.
This is what this new project is, this new book, right?
Right, it is.
We're stealing from it because we really only have 3 or 4 minutes left, but if you could introduce us to what you hope for in this book and what it, the story it will tell.
Well, it's a novel about two things, and it's about an Indian girl who is adopted by a white family and goes home to find her birth family. And it's also the story, really, of James Bay, the Hydro-Quebec project up in Canada that has been really hoping they could sell power to all the way down to Texas and have been in the process building numbers of dams and reservoirs and redirecting major rivers like the St. Lawrence and destroying sections of the Hudson's Bay.
Some of the impacts of that, I think, will be lost on folks. What's your sense of the impact of redirecting rivers and making a salt area fresh water and et cetera, et cetera?
Well, you know, it's not just a regional impact. I mean, the impact will affect all of us, I think, eventually, because you know, water has its own life, and it has its own directions and needs. And because, you know, our water birds down here, well, not down here in Alaska, but down in other states, depend on that area for nesting and for growing their infants. And so it seems to me that it's really a foolhardy notion. In addition to that, it's already uprooted many of the tribal people who live there. At one point, there was a herd of 10,000 caribou that were drowned when they took one river and rerouted it over their migration path because they didn't. That was where they always have gone, and so they went there, and the water came, and they'd all died. So it's a really destructive thing that's happening there, and not only is it ruining the ecosystem there. And the fish are dying from mercury poisoning that is coming through the rotting vegetation and the stone as places are being flooded. But, you know, the impact is much larger than just Canada. It's moving down very quickly to all of us.
Where are you in the writing process? I'm thinking of how long before this book emerges, roughly.
I'm 2 months overdue.
There's an answer.
It was due in February.
More pressure.
But I'm hoping that it will be about another month.
Okay. And this book might be seen in the next year, given publishing time?
Well, my contract originally was with Athenaeum, and they're one of the presses, one of the publishers that went out of business with this new move between Warner and Paramount in the publishing industry. So at this point, I don't have a contract, but I think my editor will probably take the book with him to wherever he goes.
Mm-hmm. Okay. A book coming out in the next year or so from Linda Hogan. Plenty of books on the shelves of libraries and bookstores to interest you. Linda, thanks so much.
Thank you.
It's been a good hour. I'm Susan McGinnis with Conversations, and I hope you'll join me again next week.